You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Philip Gurevich, the editor of the Paris Review, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate on WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. George Soros, the financier, has given away more than $4 billion through his global network of foundations dedicated to supporting open societies. He is the author of several best-selling books, including The Bubble of American Supremacy, Underwriting Democracy, and Open Society. His new book, The Age of Fallibility, is published by Public Affairs, and it brings him to the show today. And I'm going to start out today by reading very briefly from the introduction. Many people are most familiar with George Soros as a player in American public life from his role in the 2004 presidential election, when he was a major donor to MoveOn.org and other Democrat-supporting organizations and fundraising apparatus. He was very involved in the 527 funds, you may remember, which involved a loophole in the McCain-Feingold law, and gave away more than tens of millions of dollars to what became a lost cause, one might say. He writes in his prologue, "The main obstacle to a stable and just world order is the United States. This is a harsh, indeed for me painful thing to say, but unfortunately I am convinced it is true. The United States continues to set the agenda for the world in spite of its loss of influence since 9/11, and the Bush administration is setting the wrong agenda. The Bush agenda is nationalistic. It emphasizes the use of force and ignores global problems whose solution requires international cooperation. The rest of the world dances to the tune the United States is playing, and if that continues too long, we are in danger of destroying our civilization. Changing the attitude and policies of the United States remains my top priority." Mr. Soros, welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show.
My pleasure.
Now, you say that changing the policy of the United States is your top priority. You've obviously been involved in changing many societies or seeking to. In your prologue, you also describe being told by Branko Krevnikovsky, of the Prime Minister of Macedonia, who said to you, "You're a stateless statesman. States have interests but no principles. You have principles but no interests." Do you really feel that you have no state?
No, I am an American citizen, but I'm also a citizen of the world. And I just like that expression, stateless statesman, because of I really do believe that I stand for principles. And that's the point.
And when you say that the United States is sort of, at this point, the chief obstacle to many of the principles that you stand for, do you mean the United States or do you mean the Bush administration, and how do you distinguish between them?
Well, I say the United States right now because it is in the hands of the Bush administration, and they set the policy. They run the Guantanamo Bay prison, etc. So you can't at the moment distinguish. I wanted to distinguish it. That's why I worked towards against the re-election of President Bush. But he is the president. He's going to be our president for the next more than 2 years.
There is a sense, though, that when one says the United States and means the administration, that you have, in a sense, given up on an opposition. Do you feel that that there is an opposition at this point?
Of course there is, and I think that the majority of people are now opposed to the policies of the administration. Yesterday I attended my son's graduation, and the graduation speaker very clearly said, you know, our parents' generation did a good job. You will do a good job, but we have messed up. And he got a big applause for that. So I think that represents now the general feeling in the country that something has gone really fundamentally wrong.
Nevertheless, the statement that the United States is the greatest obstacle to world peace and to, let me get the exact quote that you say, the greatest obstacle to world order, a stable and just world order. Is that not at all hyperbolic when one is also confronting whether it's Al-Qaeda on the one hand or the Chinese form of communist dictatorship or Myanmar?
No, I'm afraid not, because of our power. Because we are the dominant force in the world. We set the agenda for the world. Now, of course, Al-Qaeda is a horrible organization that is, you know, we abhor it. But they have relatively little power. It's the way that we have responded to it and the way we have blown it up to be the center of our policy that has done as much damage as they have done.
When you, I mean, this seems to be very much the one of the central themes of your new book and of what you've been arguing for some time, that in a sense we've exaggerated the war on terror. The war on terror is itself a kind of spin.
Yes.
And you start the book with a philosophical discussion about thinking and reality. And your point seems to be that when spin is successful, it doesn't simply distort reality, it replaces reality, that we end up reacting to and acting upon this invented reality as if it were true. Saddam Hussein is behind 9/11, or John Kerry wasn't actually a hero on the Swift boats, these sorts of things. You chew this over, and what I wonder is, what is the antidote? How do you propose reasserting reality against its distortions?
Well, I think we need to have a better understanding of our relationship to reality. And actually, you know, the way we have learned to think because of the tradition that was established in the Enlightenment was that, you know, reality is something that is out there, that is given, and which we need to passively try to gain knowledge of. But reality is actually not entirely given. That exactly as we've gained more knowledge and the Enlightenment has, you know, led to the development of science and technology, that we can actually, to a large extent, determine what kind of world we live in. Take the issue of global warming. That's really a man-made phenomenon. So we have to understand that our thinking actually shapes reality. But because we are part of the world we try to understand, we cannot understand it properly, that our view is always distorted, and that distorted view and biased actions then shape the course of history. So we can change the world, but the result doesn't correspond to our expectations. And that is, we need to understand that. I call it, you know, our fallibility. I describe this two-way relationship as reflexivity. And I think if we understood about it, we would come closer to understanding this very complicated world in which we live. And we would understand that we can't just impose our will on the world. And that's one of the areas where we have gone wrong, because we have been so successful that the Bush administration now thinks that might is right, that because we are the dominant power, our view can be imposed on the world. And it doesn't work that way. And we now see the results, because we went into Iraq and we are bogged down in a quagmire that, in fact, we were not, nobody could really threaten our dominant position except our own stupidity. And we have done a very good job in destroying this prominent position we have reached in the world.
I'm Philip Gurevich, here today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with George Soros. This is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. You say that no one is really in possession of the truth, that the truth is, that we are fallible in our reach for the truth and so forth, and that, in a sense, that means that everything is spin. So the question then becomes not whether there's spin, it seems, but who controls it and how one gains control of it and makes it correspond, as you say, more with reality. You say it's so elusive, so constructed, the truth. And yet you say you want to change the world by doing the right thing. These are two phrases you use a lot that actually George Bush uses a lot too, that he wants to change the world and do the right thing. He seems to have equal passion and conviction when he says them. You believe he's almost always wrong. How are you always sure you're doing the right thing?
No, I'm not sure that I'm doing the right thing. But we all have to act on our convictions. President Bush is entitled to act on his convictions. But we have institutions, the institutions of democracy, which really is based on a recognition that power corrupts, that power can be misused, and you have the division of powers, and you have free speech. And those are the institutions of our democracy. And I was really quite surprised and shocked to see that these institutions are now endangered, because the source of the trouble, in my view, is actually the war on terror, because that's when a horrible thing happened to us, and it was natural that we had to respond to it. But the way the Bush administration responded, by declaring war and actually taking it literally, that we have been misled and we have gone off the rails. That's when things started really going wrong. Now, the idea that there's something wrong with the war on terror is still not recognized by the people. People generally understand that invading Iraq was a blunder and a disaster. But they still, and this applies unfortunately to the Democrats as well as the Republicans, they still think in terms of the war on terror is the natural way to respond to the terrorist attack. And I tried to show in the book that the war on terror is actually a false metaphor that has been taken literally and misused.
When you speak of the war on terror as a metaphor, how should it be done?
Well,
I mean, there are enemies of some of the things that both America and you seek to promote.
There's no question that we have to resist and deal with terrorism. But war is the wrong way to treat it. And let me give you the gist of why it's wrong. Because war, by its very nature, creates innocent victims. And war against an abstraction like terror, and when the terrorists don't actually show their face but keep hidden, is even more likely to create innocent victims. And now, we abhor terrorism because terrorists kill people for political ends. Waging war on terror, we are doing the same thing, and the people who are on the receiving end view us in the same light as we view the terrorists. And that is counterproductive. It has turned the whole world against us. And it has actually enabled the terrorists to flourish in areas where they were much less influential. So if anything is counterproductive, the war on terror is counterproductive. We need to understand this. We have difficulty in understanding it because we think of ourselves as decent people, and we are. But we've been misled. And we have to recognize and see it also from the perspective of the others who are on the receiving end of the war on terror.
I'm speaking with George Soros about his ideas for promoting freedom during an age of terrorism. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more right after this. I'm Philip Gurevich, editor of the Paris Review, here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. I'm speaking today with George Soros, the financier, philanthropist, and author most recently of The Age of Fallibility. And we've been speaking about your critique of President Bush, and Bush, of course, claims two big sources of support that you don't claim, as far as I know, God and the popular vote. We probably can't say too much here today about his conversations with God, but as a public figure, he's still somewhat accountable to public opinion. And you've even spoken about how public opinion is turning against the Iraq war, if not yet the war on terror. And his party will certainly be accountable for his policies when he's gone. You're free from accountability. You've spoken about this at times. You don't have poll ratings. You just have your fortune and a policy. Is there any downside to this, or do you just have a better job than the president?
Well, I'm not running to replace him. I have these principles. I stand up for it. And I think that's what people need to do. There have been other situations when democracy was endangered and when people failed to stand up against it. Actually, democracy was lost. You know, I grew up in the Nazi period, so I'm very much still, since my life, very life, was endangered by the German occupation. I would have been taken to Auschwitz if my father hadn't taken false papers. So I feel very strongly that one has to stand up and resist when there's a danger to open society. And as I say, I never expected that this would arise in America. I was devoting my fortune to helping the Soviet Union make the transition to democracy and my native country, Hungary, and so on. But I feel that I have got to get engaged in America.
You have made the analogy with the Bush administration and the rise of Nazism before, somewhat controversially. Do you really think that it's a fair comparison? And I guess I wonder, what do you seek to achieve by it? I mean, there is a level on which it seems that it's unlikely to persuade people who aren't already in step with you, and to actually put off people who think that you are un-American or exaggerated or a little hot under the collar or so.
I think it's a very reasonable question to ask, and there's something about which I reflect a lot. But I did explore the similarities and the differences, and of course the differences are much greater than the similarities, because we are a democracy with very strong institutions, with independent judiciary, division of powers, and so on. But if we don't watch out, we are going to lose those institutions. And that is what makes me draw attention to the dangers. If what has happened is that there has been an undue and unreasonable extension of the powers of the presidency, the executive branch, against as opposed to the judiciary and the legislature. And you've now had judges nominated to the Supreme Court who actually endorse that extension of presidential powers. And if you have this thing continue and one or two more judges, and you lose the independence of the Supreme Court. So we are genuinely endangered. It's not similar, and I make it clear, the differences are much greater than the similarities, but there is some kind of a threat. And I'm trying to also explore in the book what is the nature of that threat.
Do you foresee spending much money on American political campaigns in the future?
Well, I will be engaged in 06 as well, but not to the same extent as in 04, because then I felt that it really would make a big, big difference. I think in 06 it will make a big difference if one of the houses, presumably Congress, the House of Representatives, would change leadership, because that will open things up, and things that are currently swept under the carpet could no longer be done. So I think that is very important, and I think it's achievable.
In 2004, you really largely supported organizations like Move On and other organizations that were in a sense, political mechanisms rather than actual politicians. So they were, MoveOn was influential, obviously, in mobilizing people through the mechanism of the internet. And there were the 527s in general, which used campaigns and so forth. What I wonder is, if your concern is, as it were, the wrongs and the abuses of Bush, in your view, did you see anybody who represented the things that you favor? Did you feel that the Democrats stood for something?
I am quite critical of what of what the Democrats stand for, and I think that it's difficult to come up with the with an, a viable alternative policy, as long as you phrase or frame the discussion in the context of the war on terror. I think that is what distorts the debate, and I would like to. And that's, in fact, one of the ambitions of the book, is to question the war on terror and reveal it as a false metaphor. And then you could you are in a better position to come up with the right role for the United States. And I have rather sort of strong views on what that role is. Because being the dominant power is not just a privilege, it's a responsibility. It's a unique responsibility because it means that we have to pay attention to the common interests of humanity and not merely be concerned with our narrow self-interest. Now, that's a tall order. Particularly in a democracy where, the electorate asks the politicians, what have you done for me lately? But I think that people are beginning to realize that we do have common problems that are endangering our civilization. Climate change, global warming is one of those issues. I think the public is way ahead of the Bush administration on that issue. And it's not something that we can solve by ourselves. We do need international cooperation. The proliferation of nuclear weapons, the very real threat that Iran poses today, is another issue that requires international cooperation. So I don't think it's really that far-fetched that we really do have that responsibility. We have lived up to it in the past. We had the Marshall Plan. That's what made America great. That's how we gained that dominant position. If we want to regain it, we have to recapture that spirit.
I'm Philip Gurevich here today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC AMFM and WNYC.org, and I'm speaking with George Soros. The question, I suppose, is there's a tone at times or moments in the book where you seem to despair of the American people almost. You say, I came here, I believe in open society, I saw this as in many ways the best example of an open society, and I feel that the open society has kind of, I've lost it here. It's fading away from me because it's endorsed this administration, which you see as an enemy of open society in some at
well,
home.
I also go deeper and I ask what's wrong with America. And I say America has become a feel-good society, wants to hear only good things and is unwilling to face unpleasant reality. And because of that, reality has become very unpleasant. And that comes through in the book. There's a kind of a bitter tone to it, because I think we are in a very troublesome world, and we better wake up and face reality. And that's what I'm trying to push in the book.
Well, the question is, how does one push that from the outside if you don't have people that you can actually back in the public sphere? And I guess my question comes back to this sense that, well, some people say the American people were terribly divided in the last election and that a kind of extremism had taken over amongst people who supported Bush or so. And another view, which I often felt covering the campaign, was that, in fact, we were dispassionately divided, that there was just an absence of an opposition. For a wartime president who ran unopposed following an attack on American soil, he did very poorly. And when I say ran unopposed, there weren't ideas that struck against him very strongly. There was very little debate about the Iraq War or about torture, about Abu Ghraib, about America's influence in the world, about multilateralism, the things that in many ways now seem to be hurting him. And I wonder if you feel that there's a way that you can use your influence and your money to try to influence those things here in this country more effectively.
Well, there I really am extremely reluctant to use my money. I put my ideas forward. I hope people, including politicians, might respond to it. But I think that you should not and cannot buy elections. And I certainly am unwilling to do that because that would be contrary to my principles. So that's exactly why I don't have any firm views on who should be the next president or what he should be saying. There is a touchy issue about the use of money. So I think that I'm entitled to express my views in a book, but I wouldn't want to use my money for that purpose.
Well, when you look at the question of promoting democracy worldwide, here's something that you and your Open Society organizations, both the international hub of it here in New York, but also the many different foundations you've set up in individual countries with local actors, that's a concern that you in some ways share very directly with at least the rhetoric of the Bush administration. They say freedom must be on the march. We want to build democracies. Their rhetoric sometimes sounds very similar to the liberal hawk rhetoric that we've heard in the past. And yet there's a risk that we've seen recently. There's the risk that with free and fair elections, you can end up with the election of an anti-democratic authoritarian regime. We've seen it in Algeria. Now we see it with Hamas. We've certainly seen it in Iran with a little bit of quibbling about freeness and fairness. How do you deal with that risk when you promote open society? We've seen a little bit in Ukraine.
Well, I've been in the business of promoting democracy now for at least 15 years, actually longer than that. And, of course, the way you go about it is in supporting democratic forces within a country, but not support revolutions or forceful regime change. And certainly don't try to impose your ideas on them, because democracy, open society, requires each society to develop their own agenda of what their society ought to look like. So there is a confusion in the mind of our president between the values of open society and American values. Imposing American values is not promoting open society. So there is a falsehood in the Bush administration's approach, which has done untold damage to the development of open societies, and it's become much, much harder propagate the ideas of open society because they have been adopted by the Bush administration or misused by the Bush administration. That's actually one of the reasons why I feel so passionately, because I have been engaged, and even though we are advocating the same goal, we seem to have a different set of ideas about how to do it.
And the use of force is one of the lines you draw. I mean, are there circumstances in which the use of force has been or can be constructive in the promotion of democracy?
I'm not opposed to the use of force. I'm not opposed to defending against either terrorism or ethnic cleansing. I was a supporter of a greater engagement in the Balkans at the time when Milosevic was fostering civil war. I used to be a colleague of Paul Wolfowitz. We used to be part of a small group that was advocating a more muscular response. I think there is use there is a need for the use of force, but that should be done as a last resort when there is ethnic cleansing or actually sort of crimes against humanity. It should not, force should not be used for introducing democracy. That is a misuse of force, and it's a sort of a lame excuse for going into Iraq when the other excuses have failed.
You in your book, you suggest that the European Union could play a much bigger role and be better equipped to lead the world in the 21st century and certainly to counterbalance American power. Yet the European Union was really quite wretchedly performed wretchedly in the face of the Balkan crisis, which was its own backyard. How do you see it as in better shape now, or why do you place trust in it?
No, I think that the European Union is actually also in crisis, but the ideas prevailing in Europe are much closer to the ideas of an open society, and I think that Europe could serve as a prototype for a global open society, and I would like to see Europeans sort of accept this as a goal and a mission.
A last question for you, Mr. Soros. We started by talking about how you like the term a stateless statesman, but you've been very critical of some other philanthropists and so forth, saying that at times they allow their interests to get in the way of their principles or to coincide a little too tidily, whereas you at times work against what might be seen as your concrete interests. Is your style of being a wealthy man who is able to have a policy and implement it as aggressively as he can, is that something that you see as a desirable model for the 21st century, or is there a risk of it turning into a kind of philanthropic oligarchs who throw their weight about?
I think there is a risk of it turning into that, and it's a risk from which I myself suffer. And therefore, I'm open to criticism, and very often within my own organization, because I have foundations with local boards, and very often we are at loggerheads, and I give them credit for standing up and criticizing me and correcting me.
Thank you for coming in today. Philip Gurevich in for Leonard Lopate. I've been speaking with George Soros, whose book, The Age of Fallibility, has just been published, Consequences of the War on Terror. I think there's more about this at www.georgesoros.com as well. Thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure. I think that, by the way, that the introduction can be obtained on the Internet.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.